Well, hello again. It's the Ivan and James Martin Show, or as we should call it, the Ivan and James Martin Podcast. Isn't that right?
That's correct, yep.
Yes, here we are kicking and screaming into the fourth year of the 21st century. And today, it's a new year, it's new beginnings, it's January. And just when everybody was saying to you, oh, James, can't get any better than 2023. There's nothing else to do, nothing else to win. And what happens? A letter comes through the letterbox from the king.
Yes, it's not every day, but no, like it's a new year, so it's just it's really nice to be known.
Yes, well, it's nice to be known to the king, because he can give you letters to stick after your name. What were the ones he gave you?
He gave me an MBE.
MBE. So if we're being official and we're tugging our forelock, it's, let me see if I can get this right, it's Dr. James Martin, MBE, which sounds a lot better than not Dr. Ivan Martin with half an O level, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Bit pleased about that, I would think.
Yes, I'm very pleased and very privileged of actually getting this award. And I mean, it's, as I said to you before, it's not really every day when you get a new year in 2024 and you get a letter. It's amazing.
Now, I mean, I would point out that you have said to me on previous occasions, not every day you get a BAFTA, not every day you get an Oscar, not every day you get a NIFTA, but here we are, and the MBE, this is different. I mean, there you are. Last year you made friends with President Michael D. Higgins, with President Joe Biden. So now it looks like you could be getting to meet either King Charles III or Prince William, who's now the Prince of Wales.
But the thing is, you need to treat them as your colleagues, your friends, and that's what they expect you to do, because when you're in the public domain, you need to be very careful what you say, and you have to expect that honour.
Well, that's very young head on old head on young shoulders-ish of you to say. That's good. In today's podcast, wow, I said that as if I knew what it meant. In today's podcast, we'll be talking to some other people who were included in the New Year's Honours list. And the first of those is Michael Boyd. Michael is joining us today, but we are familiar with each other because in another life, Michael worked at the IFA. He then went to Sport NI, and it's the Communities Commission now, Michael, is it? Is that the right word? No.
It's the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission. Yeah.
The Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission. Shoot whoever did the research. Anyway, Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission, Michael Boyd, OBE. When you opened the letter, you must have thought, oh my God.
Honestly, couldn't believe it. Still actually quite in shock. And yeah, it was just one of those unbelievable moments, really.
You see, when you when you first got the letter, what was your feeling? Was it a nice feeling?
It was funny because I was in Geneva at the time. I was at a conference about business and human rights in Geneva, and I got this, it was actually an email that came into me, and yeah, at first I just couldn't believe that it was real, so I thought it was maybe like some sort of elaborate wind-up. So I forwarded the email on to my wife, and I said, Kathy, please check this. This seems to me like a wind-up. They're saying I'm getting an OBE in the New Year's Honours list, and I just couldn't get my head around it. And I thought it was maybe some sort of stitch-up. So I sent it to Kathy, and she phoned me back almost instantly, and she was like, this is no wind-up. You need to respond to this. Because I think they'd sent the letter to my old house, and we hadn't got the letter. So the first I seen it was the email, and it said this was on the Wednesday, and I think I had to respond by the Friday. And I was at this conference, and I panicked, and I sent it to the wife. She checked it. She said, yes, you need to fill this in and get straight back to them. So that's how I found out.
What was your reaction to that?
I was just like, once it sort of sunk in that this was real, I just couldn't believe it. You know, it was one of those moments where you sort of sit back and you think, whoa, it's incredible that somebody's obviously taking the time to nominate you and has thought about you in such, you know, high esteem. So whoever it was, I'm eternally grateful because it was such a lovely moment.
Not just that lovely moment with your family, but also, like, I had my lovely moment with mine. And what was your special moment? What did he do? Did he party in style, or did you?
Well, we had to sort of keep it, you know, low key until it was announced and stuff. So I actually only told my wife and my mum and my brother John. Those were the people I told, and the only reason I told my brother John was John has an OBE. Oh. So I was like, yeah, I couldn't hold it in. I had to share with John as well, but yeah, it was brilliant. Like, it was so nice, you know. My mom and Kathy and my brother were so happy for me. You know, they were just delighted. You know, and it was lovely to see how happy they were. I'm sure it was the same for you with your family.
It really was the same, but of not just my family, but also was really nice experience. And yes, it's different, but I'm sure it's going to be different for you, even though there's two people in your family got this as well.
I know, I couldn't believe it. Yeah, it was two wee lads from East Belfast getting OBEs is something incredible. And my mum, like, she brought us up on her own. She had four boys as the youngest. So I think maybe my mum deserves the OBE out of us all, but she's done all right, and we're absolutely buzzing about it.
Well, she's done better than most in that she now effectively has OBE bookends, doesn't she?
She does.
Two of you having them.
That's it. Yeah, and hopefully, I'm not sure how it's going to work, but hopefully we can bring my mum with us when we go to get it. That would be nice.
And plus, knowing when someone will come up to me and say, would you write a book? Would you write a book about this?
Wow, it's like, it's interesting. It does make you think back on what you've done. And it's funny, on Saturday here, I'm doing a TEDx talk, and it's like they've asked me to talk for 10 minutes about my journey and how, you know, sport has played a big part in my life. And it's the first time ever in my life. I'm 47 now. I turned 47 there a couple of weeks ago. It's the first time in my life I really had to stop and sort of look back and sort of take into consideration all the things that have happened. And there's been loads of ups and downs, and it's like anybody, you can't do it on your own. There's so many people you want to thank, you know, when you look back, and it's one of those things. I'm not sure anyone would buy my book, but just recently having to look back on everything, you know, it's been a lot of ups and downs, and I'm proud of the journey.
Well, on the official communication, presumably said, Michael Boyd, the King has commanded me to tell you that you have been awarded an OBE in the New Year's Honours list for, what was the for?
So it was for contribution to football, sport, charity and reconciliation.
Right.
That was the word in it, yeah.
Which, in a way, is a synopsis of your career to date, isn't it?
It is. Like, that's my passion's football, you know what I mean? And it always has been. I love sport, but football's my number one passion. I remember the 86 World Cup and seeing Diego Maradona play, and that like that just changed my life forever. You know, I was mad about football after that, and it's all through my life. I was lucky enough to work in football for 22 years in total. But even today, like in the Human Rights Commission, I look after sport and human rights across the Commonwealth and chair lots of meetings. In my spare time, I'm involved with the Glentoran Social Partnership, the County Antrim football teams, the World United Futsal, Sirocco Works, and the Rio Ferdinand Foundation as well. So I probably do more football now on a voluntary basis than I did when I was working in football, you know. So it's I've always had that sort of sport and charity connection.
When you were working at the IFA, the big thing that jumps out at me was Green and White Army. Anytime I hear that term, the first light bulb that goes off in my head is, Michael Boyd, Green and White Army. Now, I'm sure it wasn't a one-man band, but certainly you were the face of the Green and White Army. You are seen to be the man behind it. How do you feel about that on reflection?
On reflection, yeah. It's when I first got that job as Community Relations Officer for the IFA, I was buzzing because I love football. I was absolutely ecstatic that I was getting a job in football. But everybody kept telling me, you've got the hardest job, the worst job in football. And you have to sort of take, you have to take people back to what it was like, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000. And there was problems with sectarianism, and the crowds were as low as 4,000 at some of the games. And it was a much different time. And then obviously there was the Neil Lennon incident where he suffered the death threat when he was going to go play for Northern Ireland because he was a Glasgow Celtic. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to explain what it was really like back then to people now, because they see the new stadium and they see most of the games are sold out. And I'm not saying it's perfect now, but it's so much better than it used to be. That job, it's funny, like I was young and full of enthusiasm and just absolutely buzzing to be working in football. And I was lucky that I knew some people within the Northern Ireland fans, amalgamation of Northern Ireland supporters clubs, who were quite influential within the supporter base. And they knew that I was a big Northern Ireland fan, and they supported me in the campaign. So I had to write a whole Football for All strategy, and I had to engage the supporters, had to talk to them about tackling the issue around sectarianism and creating a better atmosphere. And it wasn't the one-man show. Like it needed the support of the Community Relations Council, the Northern Ireland fans. It needed the support of the wider public and media. There were so many people to thank when you look back on it. But thankfully, after the Neil Lennon incident, which acted as almost like a bit of a catalyst for the work, things really started to change. And things like the Sea of Green, which was a Northern Ireland fans' idea. It was a guy actually called Gareth Todd who contacted me. He's from the north of England, Northern Ireland supporters clubs. And he was like, I love what you're doing with Football for All. Could we do something a bit like what the Dutch do? They have the Sea of Orange, but could we do a Sea of Green at the games to help sort of with the Football for All atmosphere? And because that was fan initiative and was fan driven, the supporters got behind it. It was almost like Football for All was the fans' campaign rather than the IFA's campaign. And that was part of the secret of the success of why we were able to transform things.
But was it different just to have different jobs when you started off in the IFA up to now, and next minute it gets even better than that, you know?
Yeah, it's funny, like I started off in football as a work experience student. So my first experience was going in as a student, and I was unpaid, that was voluntary. And I did 8 months in the mini soccer team away back in 1998, that was. And then I got the job in community relations in 2000. I worked I was a volunteer work experience student. I was a development officer. I was a manager. I was a head of department. And then I was a director. So I worked at all the different levels, all the way up to the senior team. And that gave me a really good picture of how football operates and how it works. And now I work in the Human Rights Commission, and I'm a special projects manager. So I get to work around projects around sport and human rights, business human rights. And I get to work internationally across the Commonwealth, and there's around 40 countries involved in our Commonwealth work. So I've got to see lots of different things. I think I'm really glad that I made the move away from football, and I'm really glad I'm doing what I'm doing now. I loved my experience in football, but if I'd have stayed there, I wouldn't have had these other experiences. And I think when I reflect, you know, having done all those different jobs and made those moves, it's all just helped get me to where I am today, and I'm in a very happy place.
I know that I've met a lot of well-known people But have you met well-known people of the days when you started off as a young fella until now?
Yeah, like 100%. Even when I joined the IFA as a student, on a student placement, way back in 98, like I was surrounded by people. Like there was Mal Donaghy was in there, Paul Kirk, Kenny Shields, Ian Stewart, Spike Hill, Trevor Erskine. Like these were all people that I really looked up to. Like Mal Donaghy had played in two World Cups, and I was like this little student placement in amongst all these famous footballers. And it was funny, like the likes of Mal Donaghy and Ian Stewart really took me under their wing, and they showed me how to do coaching, how to basically develop football, you know, in the grassroots. And I was so lucky. So when I look back, like I was doing that all free, but that was priceless, you know, the experience that I got. And during my journey in football, I got to meet George Best, I met Pelé, you know. It's like people can't say that they, you know, things like that, you know. It's only now when I'm saying it out loud, you realize how lucky and how fortunate, you know, I was to meet people. Like I got to sit beside Billy Bingham once at a big charity dinner, and Billy Bingham just blew me away. He was an amazing, you know, character as well. So yeah, for somebody who loves football, getting to meet those sort of people. The only one footballer I didn't get to meet that I would love to have met was Diego Maradona. He's like my idol in football. But yeah, I've been very fortunate to meet some really famous people.
It's really nice when you meet those kind of people and you just want to punch yourself.
Well, you must have met some amazing famous people recently too.
Trust me, it's not easy.
Who did you meet?
I've met a lot of well-known people on the day for the Oscars, like Dwayne Johnson is one.
The Rock,
that's right. It's Coogan. But you see, when you talk to them, it's kind of like you're in a twist of struggle. And they expect you to be a colleague and a friend. I'm sure that's the same as you, you know.
Yeah, 100%. Like the people like Mal Donaghy and, you know, people who I really looked up to who were big names in football. Like the ones, what I found was the ones who had achieved loads were the most humble.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Most down to earth, the most normal. And never really talked about their achievements. Always wanted to, you know, stay in the present and look into the future. And that was something I learned early on, you know, just everybody's a normal person. I felt sorry when I saw Pelé. I actually felt sorry for Pelé because he couldn't take, it was at Barcelona's ground, the Nou Camp. There was a big conference. And then in the evening, everybody who had spoke at the conference got invited to the King's Box to watch the game. And I was lucky I'd got to speak at the conference, and I came to the King's Box and Pelé was there. And he couldn't walk two steps without people, you know, trying to get a photograph with him or asking him questions. And I don't know how he managed, you know, to get about. But I actually did get to meet him briefly and got a photograph with him as well. And probably I'm one of those people who was annoying him. But yeah, he's probably the most famous person I've ever been in the presence of.
Because I'm quite new to it myself. But the one thing is, you put your head down and walk out.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing, you know. I know that was hard for him, but when it gets stopped a lot, but it just grows on you, you know. It just takes years of practice.
Yeah, well, no, you've done so well. Like, I've seen you at all the big sporting events and on social media and everywhere. You're like, you're everywhere I look these days, and it's brilliant. And it's so lovely we got to talk to you on our podcast and working. You were so brilliant, and it's lovely to get to spend time with you.
It was just nice to have that feeling and nice to have that friendship going.
Yeah.
Two things before we finish. One, have you ever met a more modest person than Mal Donaghy?
No, and it's funny, yesterday I was, on Saturday, a couple of days ago, I was over at the Inclusion League over at the Valley, and Mal's one of the referees, and I referee as well, and we help our friend Alan Crooks. And when I arrived, this is typical Mal. He got down on one knee and did a big bow, you know, because of the OBE. And like, you know, Mal Donaghy, he's one of these people, you know, like he taught me so much, and he's so humble and he's so kind, and he gives up his time, you know, for the inclusion leagues and all the different IFA disability football programs. And he's just an incredible, down-to-earth, humble person. And I learned so much from Mal. But no, in Northern Ireland football, I've never met anybody as humble or as kind as Mal.
Billy Bingham used to call him, he's my Rolls Royce, Ivan, you know. Malachy is wonderful. He's my Rolls Royce.
And that's a good way to describe it. And even a couple of years ago, we were playing a charity football match, and Mal must have been, you know, he must be in his 60s. And we were playing this under 21 team. And one of the wee boys is going to Aberdeen. And Mal didn't give him a kick. He just, he knew where the ball was going to be 5 minutes before the young lad. And the young lad, I hope he has a great career and all. But Mal Donaghy, just football wise, was on another planet.
Roy Coyle used to say, the first 10 yards are in his head.
Yeah, you know? That's Mal. Mal could see, not only was he able, like we were playing alongside him and we were all average footballers, he made us all 10 times better just by talking to us and just letting us know what was going to happen and where to be. And yeah, the fact that he played for United and Chelsea and Luton and two World Cups, he's just an unbelievable talent.
He's a marvellous guy. He was a wonderful footballer and certainly was somebody who never lost the run of himself. Mm. He was a great fella and still is.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to ask you about, you mentioned it earlier, futsal. Right. Tell us about futsal. I remember years ago ringing you and saying, Michael, what is futsal?
Yeah.
And you said to me, do you want to do an article about it? Yeah.
You know, when I first joined the IFA in the communications office, there used to be, this is how old I am, there was a fax machine with all the buttons and numbers, and there was an Ivan Morton button alongside, you know, there was like Sunday Live, Belfast Telegraph, and then there was an Ivan Morton one. I remember thinking, this guy must be important. The futsal. I first came across futsal. I was at a FIFA conference in Argentina in 2001, and it was me, Jim Boyce, and David Curry were at this conference, and we were driving there. We arrived in Buenos Aires, and we were getting driven from the airport to the hotel, and it was like 1 a.m, and everywhere along the side of the road was these futsal courts with the lights, and these men and women who had obviously like been chefs and waiters and stuff out playing futsal, you know, straight out after the restaurant out and playing. And this was the first time I'd ever seen futsal, so I was really interested in it. And then the Northern Ireland Council for Ethnic Minorities, they had a group of about 20 people who were newly arrived in Northern Ireland from different parts of the world, and they asked me to go down and do a bit of coaching with them. And I met the group, and they were Portuguese, they were African, they were South American, Brazilian, all sorts of different types of people. And they said to me, we don't want to play five-a-side, we want to play futsal. And I was like,
what's the difference?
So the difference is it's a smaller ball. It's like a size 4 ball. It's a bit heavier.
Right.
So it doesn't bounce as much. In our old five-a-side, you know, you can kick the ball off the wall and stuff. You can't do that in futsal. You have to play within the lines. It's almost like a hockey net rather than a traditional five-a-side net. Futsal is fast flowing. It's like you transition from defense to attack like this. It's a bit like basketball, you know, back and forth. Mm-hmm. It's just unbelievable. For skill development, players like, you know, Maradona, Ronaldinho, all these players outside of actually UK, everywhere else in the world, they don't play five-a-side like we do. They play futsal, and it's really good for your technical development. And it's funny, that World United team that I set up 20 years ago here in Belfast with all those different nationalities, they now play in the futsal league, and my players from 20 years ago are the managers and the coaches of futsal. And it's just brilliant the way it's grown. Like when we first started, there was no futsal, and now there's a futsal league, and the winners play in the UEFA Futsal Champions League and stuff. It's just really it's one of those sports that's really taken off.
Amazing. You know, there's so many aspects of it that people just don't know about, you know, and you with your marketing background could have a field day with that if you weren't doing so many other important things.
Well, what I love about the World United Futsal is they've always delivered like anti-racism training as well as offering football to everybody and futsal to everybody. And what I loved recently, they asked me back. I have a little part-time consultancy where I help charities and sports with their strategy development. And World United brought me in, and it was so lovely to see the likes of Aruna and Tony and Reg, who were my players 20 years ago, now leading the World United Futsal. And when we were doing the strategy, they still wanted the social targets. You know, they wanted to have the anti-racism workshops, the engagements with the schools, alongside wanting to be the best futsal team in Northern Ireland. You know, and it was just like, for that to have started 20 years ago and for it to be going so strong now was just lovely to see.
Yeah, well, talking of lovely, it's been lovely to talk to you as ever. There's so much we could talk about, but as they say in the media, time has beaten us. But Michael Boyd, OBE, congratulations, and I hope you and your girls have a fantastic day on the day you're awarded the OBE.
Thank you so much, and thanks for inviting me on to your podcast. It's such an honour and a privilege to be here with you both, and congratulations again to James.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Cheers, Michael.
Cheers. Thanks, Evan. Cheers.
Well, today on the podcast, we've been talking about the New Year's Honours List. James got an MBE, and our next guest also got an MBE, and it is Canon Kevin Graham. Kevin, lovely to have you on. Thank you for agreeing to do so. And we'll let your fellow MBE kick things off.
I just want to talk about both your feeling, Nick, when you got that letter from the King.
First of all, thanks for inviting me to come along and share with you on this podcast. It's a pleasure to do so. I don't even think a lot of my parishioners know this necessarily, but every Saturday morning, there's three of us who would meet in the church and set up for a Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And there was this particular Saturday in November, and we were doing our usual setting up, and about 11:30, 12, usually have a cup of coffee. Went over to the church hall, stuck the kettle on, discovered there was no milk in the fridge, so I nipped over to the house behind the church hall and opened the door, and here was this white envelope with a window on it, and at the top of it says, "On His Majesty's Service," and then it said, "Personal and Urgent," and then below the window, "Cabinet Office," and with this cream writing paper through the window, and I thought, what's this? Well, I kind of had an inclination, it could only be one thing. And I took it into the kitchen, opened the letter, and it was almost like a set paralysis. You didn't believe what you were reading in front of you. And I read it 3-4 times, and then I remembered I was over to get milk. And I put the letter back in the envelope, took it into my study, opened, I have a lockable drawer in my desk, put it in there, locked the drawer, and went over with the milk and sat down and thought, this is surreal, because I'm not allowed to tell anybody what has just happened, that I've been nominated to receive an MBE. And of course, apart from the shock and the paralysis, and the first question I asked myself was, why me? What had I done to deserve this? And then just kind of felt really surreal, really just... But then you had to go make a cup of tea and eat your biscuits and finish preparing the church. Because whilst it was a fairly significant moment, life didn't change at all. It couldn't change at all. Just everything that was you had to do that day had to be done that day. So,
was it a nice feeling, you know, not just receiving it, but also a nice feeling, not just drinking coffee or biscuits, but if you take anything, was that your special thing?
I mean, I think it took a while to process that it was a nice thing, you know. Yes, ultimately, because the initial thing was shock and disbelief and wondering why. And then when you kind of work out that you can't get answers to those questions immediately, like why me? Because you never see the details of the nomination about you. So then you start to realize, well, someone obviously somewhere has felt that I've done something worthy enough to write to... the Cabinet Office to nominate me for an honour, and that what made it feel like a really nice thing, and that somebody had recognised worth in what I'd done, and so that made it feel really, really nice. Yeah.
There's a degree of mystery around it though, Kevin, isn't there? Because you don't know who nominated you. Maybe you do know, but it just You know, it seems that a lot of people never know who nominated them.
I know who started the ball rolling,
mm-hmm.
but I know other people know me, and I don't know who they actually are, what their identities is. But yes, there's a lot of mystery surrounds the whole thing, and about embargoes till 10:30 on the 29th of December, and who can you tell before and who can't you? Well, basically, they're expected to tell nobody. But there's nothing they can do to punish you if you do. But there is a sense of the awesome about it, and that, you know, awesome is something that we're held in awe because we don't know it all of its entirety. So there is a lot of mystery, and I think it maybe adds a lot to the mystique of the whole honours system, you know, and perhaps even contributes some in some ways to some of the critiques of the honours system as well, that it is so mysterious, and that you know, the information is it's very secretly held about you then in connection to your award. But you know,
there seems to be a feeling that if it gets into the public domain, that they could withdraw it. You know, a lot of people have said that to me, you know, oh, you couldn't say anything to anyone because they would take it away from you. You know, and it, as you say, there is that mystique about it, you know. Did they obviously told you why you had got it. What did they say about that?
So in the letter, you get an accompanying page that you have to send back by email to say whether or not you accept the award, or if you decline it. If you decline it, you have to say why. And then at the bottom, there's a little bit that says, this is what we're going to put on it about the award. And so it's your citation, is a technical term. So my interest for service to the reserve forces and to the community in Belfast. So I had served as an Army Reserve chaplain, started off in the TA in 2005. I left in 2020 for personal reasons, but in that time of working with the reserve forces as a chaplain with an infantry unit and then a field hospital at the end, obviously someone who I'd worked with in that time had seen that what I was doing was somehow over and above what they'd expect a chaplain to do. So, and then some of the work I did in the community in Belfast also been recognised that it's not something that, you know, kind of maybe the rector of St. Bartholomew's would normally historically been at. So it was doing something more than just my job. And so those are the two areas and whatever. But I still haven't got the detail of any of that. And that remains mysterious as well, you know. So it does.
I take it when you, not just receive it, but also when you are honoured an MBE, did that really over the moon, or were you very happy?
I suppose, again, if we ignore the initial shock and awe, then certainly as time has moved on, I'm truly humbled and honoured by it, and I'm delighted to have received it. I'm looking forward to a trip to London, whether it's Buckingham Palace or Windsor or whatever. I think it'll be a great day, and we've actually planned a whole family event for about 5 days around it whenever we get the date. I am very pleased. I'm extremely happy. But what I don't ever want to come across is big-headed about it, you know. But I do like the fact that my signature box now has got MBE after my name. So I do like looking at that every now and again just to remind myself that. Because I have to tell you this, that between getting the letter and seeing it in print, I had a dream, and in the dream the list came out, my name wasn't on it. So I kept saying to myself, I don't believe this until I see it in print. And but I had a funeral that afternoon, the day that it came out, and during the course of the funeral I had a missed call on my phone, which I picked up quite late on that evening, and it was a voicemail from a newspaper wanting to talk to me about my award. That was at 3:15 in the afternoon. Of course, anything I might have said would have been embargoed till 10:30. But then I did know for definite my name was on the list. So I started to relax at that point. It was after 6 o'clock. on that. But until I had seen it in print myself, I was reluctant to completely, utterly be, because as you said, there's always, because the wee bit in the letter that says, subject to final inquiries, which kind of holds you in that tension of, am I getting it or not? And you mm-hmm. don't know, because they tell you as well, they won't contact you again
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
until, unless they need more information. So you don't know by not contacting you if they found something out about you to take it off you, you know, in that meantime. But as I say, once the reporter had phoned, then I knew my name was on the list and I started to relax about it all.
Funny how it's the same, but yeah. It's just really nice to be relaxed mm. and not just kind of an honour, but yeah. also it's a build up. It's the going over to just to pick it up, mm. and also it's really lovely when you can invite not just my family, but you can invite your family mm. too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know. See, we're really looking forward to it. I've two boys, and the younger son he's played cricket in Sri Lanka. He's been to America. He's in Val Thorens doing a ski season at the moment. But the one place in the world where he hasn't been, where the rest of us have been over several times, is London. So it would be really lovely to take him over on such a special occasion. And as you say, as we were saying the other day, you know, if perchance we get the same date, we can make a real party of it in
of
London.
Course.
So we can.
Of course we can.
Yes, it would be interesting. Now, James and I were at Buckingham Palace last year for the Coronation Garden Party. But this is a different ball game altogether. One of the things James said to me was, you know, we obviously met Joe Biden last year mm-hmm. and Michael D. Higgins, two presidents and so on. But he said to me, I've never met the king.
Mm.
You've met the king, I presume, have you?
I have met the king, yes.
Yeah.
Last, as part of the season of the garden parties, there's two in London, two at Buckingham Palace. There's one at Holyrood in Edinburgh and there's one at Hillsborough. So I got a letter out of the blue one afternoon as well. I got home from work and on the back of it was the garden party office, a Northern Ireland office was a sticker. So in it was an invitation to the garden party. And then, so I accepted that, and then you get there are details about how to get there and here's your entrance card and all that. But about a week before the garden party itself, I then got another letter saying that Cheryl and I had been chosen to meet the Secretary of State whilst we were at the garden party, which is code for you will meet the member of the royal family who's there.
Yeah.
You don't know who it's going to be. But on the day we arrived, we were going, which was the 24th of May last year, which was my birthday. And I thought it was very nice of the royal family to have arranged such a nice day for my birthday.
Yes.
But of course, we found out that morning that the King and the Queen had arrived into Northern Ireland for a day or two's visit. So the presumption was that they were going to be there for the royal hosts at the Hillsborough Garden Party. And that was the case. But then, as you know, from Buckingham Palace too, because of the number of people, whoever the royal couple is, they usually split. And one goes one way and one goes the other.
That's right.
So the route that we were put on, the place we had to stand to for the royal walkabout, we were told that that was the route that the King was going to go on. So Cheryl and I were introduced to the King by the Vice Lord Lieutenant of the County Borough of Belfast, we were the guests of the Lord Lieutenant of the County Borough of Belfast, Dame Fionnuala J. Boyle. So her Vice Lord Lieutenant, Dr. Alan Logan, introduced me to the King, and then I introduced Cheryl to the King. We had a little conversation. And a bit of a laughter. I've got a lovely picture of me and him smirking together. So about a joke we'd shared. So yeah, it was a lovely occasion. He's a really, really, you know, affable chap. He really is very easy to talk to. And maybe it's the years of practice, but he makes you feel like he's known you all your life. Yeah, he's a really nice man.
But that experience really good, just to meet these guys. Not just going to like a legs of the garden party, but what's that experience like?
I mean, it is really, really good. I mean, I say, for someone who might meet hundreds of people a day, as the King, the Queen, Prince William, any of the senior working members of the royal family might do, when you actually meet them, they actually feel, you feel like they're giving you their full attention. They make you feel as important as they are. They really are. And they're, so I've met Prince Andrew in the past. I've met the King recently. And as I say, you could cynically think they're trained to do it like this, but it just seems to be how they are naturally, and they do make you feel important, and you know that there's someone who's, you know, who literally is important. He's a very, very important person standing around you, but they make you feel likewise an important person because they listen to you, they take the time to speak to you, and ask you questions, so they make you feel valuable. The conversation I had with the King on that occasion, you know, he remembered the event I was talking about, which again makes you think, it makes you feel that there was a significance in it for him that makes you, again, gives you value, so you do feel important about it all, yeah.
I take it when you're very important, does that mean that you're kind of in the family circle?
Who, me?
Yeah.
In the royal family circle?
Yeah.
No, I'm very, very far removed from the royal family circle. I know, for that moment, maybe when you're meeting them, you feel like there's a closeness there, there's a bond there, whatever. But I'm a wee man from Strabane, like another wee man from Strabane, you might know. I'm a wee man from Strabane.
It's a nice place, I know.
And I feel completely rooted and grounded in who I am, and I'm in no way am I, as much as I have had occasion to meet the King, been honoured with an MB, work as a Deputy Lieutenant of the County Borough of Belfast, I'm still just wee Kevin Graham from Strabane, you know.
Yeah.
But as part of the fabric of our life here, mm-hmm. On occasions, you are invited to things or you become part of things which are in an integral part of your life. And, you know, somebody said recently, life's about making memories.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something for both of you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a memory that you are unlikely ever to forget.
I think that's a question for you.
Well, I suppose depends how long I live and how long my mind remains active, but certainly it'll be, you know, it'll be a fairly significant event. I'm trying to, you know, I don't know if it's helpful to create a hierarchy of events in your life, but certainly there are things that are up there, there's no doubt about it, like your wedding day. The first time you have a child, when I first flew in an airplane by myself, flew solo, I never will forget that experience. But then to be, you know, I was involved in organising the service for the after the death of Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth in St Anne's Cathedral. I mean, that's something I'll never forget. And the events around the 5 days preparing for that, I'll never forget that. I won't forget the Saturday morning, sitting in shock, having my tea and coffee, not being able to tell my two friends what had just happened. And I no doubt will not forget the experience of going to either Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle to receive an MBE. And, you know, it's lovely to have those memories. Absolutely lovely to have those memories. And maybe even with a bit of luck, James, we might even get to dine out on them now and again.
Well, actually, I think that would be nice. Wouldn't it? You know, it would be really lovely. That to me was a nice experience too. When I got my honorary doctorate, it was a lovely moment. But this moment of getting an MBE, a lot of people from Northern Ireland, we represent the city, and that's big.
I think it is a very significant moment in anybody's life, and I mean, you've had a year full of big moments. I mean, there's not many people have been part of a winning Oscar team, a BAFTA and an IFTA team. So, and your honorary doctorate is phenomenal. If this is the icing on the cake, right?
Right.
There's not much left to go on top. We'll have to get It's something you want on top of the cake at some point. What's the candle going to be, you know?
Never mind the cherry and on top of it.
So, I think it's been a phenomenal year for yourself, and you know, and long may it continue. Long may, you know, these experiences inform the future for all of us. And but I think it's, you know, certainly for me, I think, you know, I probably received as much from the reserve forces and as much from the community of Belfast as more than I probably have given. I've probably received as much back, and I suppose from your acting career, you've probably received far more back than you give, because it just,
you do though.
You don't you? You really do though.
No, you're totally right. It's not just giving it back, but you're giving it forward to people, and that's really lovely too. Yeah. You
it's
know,
just lovely to be able to share and to help and to support and to encourage and you know, and if someone feels that because of what you've done in that respect, then that's worthy of an honour, then we humbly accept those and enjoy the moment for what it is, you know, because they don't come along very often, moments like this in life. You know?
It's a special moment.
Yeah, it really is.
One of the things I've learned, and it took me a long time to learn it, is that you have to celebrate the special moments, because A, they don't come along very often, and B, you know, there are, life is a roller coaster, and when it's down there, you need the memories of those good moments to help pick you up again, you know. The morning after James won the Oscar, I got a call from a friend. He said to me, I just rang you to say I was watching the Oscars and I saw all those Hollywood A-listers standing up and singing Happy Birthday to James. I said, yes, that was a great moment for him. He says, yes, but not for you. How do you follow that next year?
Yes. You know, absolutely.
I mean, I would say to people now, you can't top that one. But I'm having a small one, hopefully this year. But I mean, you just couldn't plan your birthday on the day of the Oscars. I mean, you just couldn't write that. It's a bit the same thing when we go. You couldn't write it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, like, even the coincidence of going to visit the King on my birthday last year, you know, I mean, you know, what scheme of anything could that have been planned to have worked out that way? Now, it's insignificant to everybody there whose birthday isn't the 24th of May, or wasn't the 24th of May. But for me, you know, it was a really nice thing to do on your birthday. Well, it wasn't. It meant as well that Cheryl didn't have to worry about buying too many presents, because I was getting a treat
of course.
To see the King. Although I didn't, you know, we knew we were going to see somebody, but only that morning it was the King, you know.
So. Did they sing Happy Birthday to you?
Unfortunately not. No, I'm not just up there with you, James, so they didn't sing Happy Birthday to me. In fact, nobody sang Happy Birthday to me that day, not even Cheryl. So, but then, you know, now that I've mentioned Cheryl, I mean, I would have a lot to say thank you to Cheryl and the boys for, because at times when I was off supporting the reserve forces or the community office, I had left them at home, but they were very supportive of me and doing what I did. And I know that you will have the support of your family as well, and doing all that you've done over the years, you know, to get you where you're at. So we owe them a great deal of gratitude for supporting us to get us to this point where, in some ways, we might have received the honour, but in a whole lot of ways, they did all the work, you know, to support us as well, you know, so.
Be nice if it was a big work deal, you know, really. But no, look, it's really lovely. It's just really nice. We can celebrate that in style, hopefully.
We will do.
Well, gentlemen, I trust you have a memorable day at the palace, each of you and your families, when it comes around. I'd be interested to see the dress code. Do we have to wear morning suits or what? you know. We shall see. You were seen wearing a morning suit on television recently, but that's an entirely different thing.
It is indeed.
So can we say thanks to Canon Kevin Graham for joining us on the podcast, and thanks to you for your questions.
No problem. Do anything for anybody. You know, really.
Thank you
but
very much for
again,
asking me along. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
And congratulations.
Okay.
You'd be surprised that was 23 minutes.
So much for 10 minutes each. dear me.
Quite amount of editing to do.
There's no editing in any of that. It's no. It's just really nice. Lovely.
Yeah. It flowed nicely. Yeah.
And we point coffee cloth are really lovely. Yeah. You know.
No, that's easy peasy. There's just a couple of wee splices to do, a couple of wee mistakes I made, but easy peasy.
Right, well, as long as you're happy, we're happy. We were at the last night of the pantomime last night.
Oh, right, right.
And Jenkins and Lennon had said, you know, go up to the thing afterwards and we'll be round. The cast are all coming, you know. So we're up there, and Jenkins was heading off this morning to Alicante. And he said, I have to leave and get this done. We'll get home because we're playing the catch in the morning. And Lanahan says, I'm on a plane on Tuesday myself. And I didn't say anything. And the conversation went on, and then he says, I'm on a plane on Tuesday myself. And somebody said, oh, where are you going? And he says, nowhere, I'm just taking a bit off the bottom of the door. Right. And he then says, he has known me too long. He didn't bite on that. Lennon and I played under 18 football together.
Right, okay.
So we're both now, well, in a couple of weeks, I'll be 72.
Right.
So the fact that we're still here is...
He didn't have any children from Ballymena last night, no?
No.
Well, he did have children now, but it was all different, you know.
There were people in from Carrick. And where are you from, Carrick? And the next, where...